welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hello, creatives. I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 290 of the podcast. And it is the 8th of October, 2016, as I record this. And I am frantically getting everything ready to head off to America on Tuesday. So I'm recording tons of stuff in advance. It's all very crazy around here, but I am doing this intro for you guys today. And it is a bit of a longer one, I think, as I'll tell you more about it in a minute. But first of all, today, I actually have an interview with me on the successful author mindset. I was interviewed by the lovely Jeff and Will from the Big Gay Fiction podcast, which is just awesome. But if you missed that show, we covered some important topics. So I've included the interview here today because I get emails every week about how mindset is such a huge issue for people, people struggling with self-doubt, with fear of failure, from comparing themselves to other authors. And as I have literally, I'm just about to print my first draft of End of Days. And I've had a bit of a tough month with this kind of roller coaster of creativity that we all go through. So I wanted to, you know, to post this interview for anybody who is struggling with those roller coaster emotional issues to do with creativity. So I hope you enjoy the interview. So, publishing news this week. For those of you who are on my email list and received my email newsletter yesterday, I talked a bit about this, but the biggest news this week is launch of Prime Reading. So Amazon Prime Reading, which is a curated program where Amazon are picking content and, you know, for Amazon Prime. So I'm a Prime customer. Basically, you pay a certain amount per year and you get free shipping, you get TV, you get things like storage, you get a whole load of stuff included in your Prime account, as well as now Prime Reading. So it is books, magazines, I think there's some audiobooks, and a whole load of stuff included with Prime. Now, instead, it's not KDP Select, although it seems like the books that are in it are either traditionally published, Amazon published, or KDP Select, although that is hearsay, that is not official. And the author gets a fixed amount for a certain period, so say 3 months, and the content that's in the Prime Reading will be rotated in and out, which to me feels a bit like Netflix. Now on Netflix, I'm also a Netflix customer, you get a certain amount of content that comes in every month. And, you know, kind of one of the big things is, you know, what's arriving on Netflix this month and what is leaving Netflix this month. There's whole blogs devoted to the things that are rotating in and out of Netflix. And also Amazon Prime TV has the same thing, a film. So I think Amazon Prime Reading is very, very interesting. And there's been quite a few people freaking out on a number of the author forums, Facebook groups, all of that type of thing. And to be fair, I had a look at this and kind of gulped, because I think that this could be very good for customers, as ever. And any decision Amazon makes is usually around customer satisfaction. They don't, you know, authors are not their number one concern, obviously. We make very little money for Amazon as a company as a whole. But what is amazing is that they are always focusing on giving the customer more. Now, I'm not in KDP Select, as in I am not exclusive with Amazon for most of my books, but I completely get where they're coming from with this. I think that the Prime model, the paid subscription model, is fantastic. What I fear we have lost with KU, Kindle Unlimited, and with you know, a lot of self-publishing in general, is that curated model. Now, I'm like weeping over here because, of course, one of the reasons we love being indie is that the gatekeepers, the supposed gatekeepers, are gone and we have a level playing field. But what is happening is because there's so many books that there is a rise of curation and merchandising. And this is a merchandising activity as far as I can see. Now, I'm not getting depressed about this. And what I said in my newsletter yesterday as well is, we have to think about a couple of things. One is, why are we doing this in the first place? So for many of us, we're not able to not write. Writing is what we have to do anyway. So what you have to keep coming back to when things like this happen, this is not the end. There was also something else about KU page reads being affected by page flip, a technical glitch that has affected royalties. I'm pretty sure Amazon will fix that. There's also been this week the thing around incentivized reviews now being banned, except for books. It's clearly stated in the release that it is not related to books, but everyone was freaking out about that. So all this stuff has happened this week. And I want to say, again, you've got to come back to, why are you doing this? What is the reason? Don't get thrown off track by any of these things that are going on. Focus on why you're writing, enjoying your writing, but also focus on the bigger picture. Because, you know, if we look at how things are going in the world, one of the brilliant things that I saw this week that people aren't seem to be talking about very much is that Mark Zuckerberg was in Lagos in Nigeria. Now, many of you know that I talk a lot really about the growth globally in the exciting things that can happen if you publish wide, if you don't think about just America, because this new Prime Reading, I believe, is just in America. It might move out to the UK, et cetera, et cetera. But most of this stuff is really only affecting the American market. Now, obviously, that's a lot of money for most people at the moment, but things are changing. So Mark Zuckerberg was in Lagos meeting people in the startup and tech culture. Now, Nigeria is a hugely entrepreneurial country. There's a massive growth of the mobile economy in sub-Saharan Africa and India right now. And of course, Amazon is investing heavily in India. There is a huge middle class, educated middle class, who speak English in Nigeria, and also expat Nigerians, of which my sister-in-law is one of them. So I know a few things about this. And I am selling books in Nigeria through Kobo and also other sub-Saharan African markets. So what I want you to do whenever these kind of big stories come up and we go, oh my goodness, everything is changing, the sky is falling. This will not stop changing, okay? We live in a time of massive technological change, and I'm someone who embraces that as positive. Every time we have a change that makes things better for the customer, we have to celebrate that. And many of us are readers as well as writers. Well, I imagine we all are. So we have to think about it that way. So I want you to hold on to these two things. One, you know, why are you writing anyway? Would you do this even if you didn't make any money at all? And in fact, many people do. And then the second thing is, there's a huge market coming online. Peter Diamandis's book, Bold, which I really urge you to read, talks about the 5 billion new consumers coming online by 2020 as the world gets the internet. That's what I'm excited about. I think it was 45% of my book sales income last year was from the US. I fully expect that to be less this year, and I expect the growth in these other markets to be much faster between now and 2020, for example. And given that next year is 2017, this is not far away. So I fully expect that the ebook market that we live in, you know, will continue to go through these massive changes. The good news is, if you own your rights, there's tons of stuff that you can do as things change to jump in and join whatever the new channel is. So please buckle up for the ride that is our exciting entrepreneurial author life, and get creating. What doesn't change in this environment is the need for great stories, educational or inspirational nonfiction. These things will sell. So I hope that helps. So on personal news, I finished the draft of End of Days, the first draft, and I'm much happy with it now. I did have huge self-doubt around some of the story elements, but you know, I'm happy with it and it's a first draft. So I'm now going to add to it as we travel in Israel over the next, it will be 2 weeks' time. I'll be there. I'll be adding in some scenes. I'll be rewriting or adding layers to the scenes I already have. We'll also be taking some video and pictures. And if you want to follow the trip, I will be sharing on facebook.com/JFPenAuthor. I'll be updating pictures, and that'll be the end of October, beginning of November. So keep an eye out there. Also, I mentioned last show about moving to Vellum for formatting. Well, this week I did my box sets on Vellum, and oh my goodness, it is so good. It's just a drag and drop. So really happy with the way Vellum does box sets. If you're if you haven't yet got into box sets, it is a big chunk of my income at Kobo and iBooks in particular. So well worth doing. To get those files done, really, really super easy. I'm also getting now my audio box set sorted. So this is something that I think is interesting as an Audible listener. And this is the thing, I wasn't into, like, as a customer, I wasn't into audiobooks. I wasn't into Kindle Unlimited until earlier this year. And I got into both of them because I wanted to see what the customer's experience was. So what I noticed with Audible is you pay a certain monthly subscription, and that is worth a certain amount of money. And what I find myself doing is looking for deals on the audio books where my subscription is worth a lot less than the audiobook itself. So there might be an audiobook that's £20 or one credit. So I've got a credit which is worth a lot less, like £7.99, and I will get a really good deal if I get this bigger audiobook. So I've noticed my own behavior as an audio listener. So why I'm now doing audio box sets is because I want my books to be a good deal to people who are doing this. Now, I tend to write shorter novels, so by putting them together in a box set, it's going to make it a much better deal. So I'm really expecting to have more sales on Audible if I have audio box sets. I'll let you know if that actually works, but I know some indie authors who are doing box sets and doing very well on audio for that. I'm also going to be recording some more nonfiction for audiobooks before Christmas. So 2017, I expect to have some more nonfiction books on Audible. Okay, so I'm in the middle of scheduling the next 4 shows in advance in case I don't get a good enough internet signal at the various places I am over the next month. So if I do get a signal, then I will swap out the files. But if I don't get a chance to do any further updates, there'll be a ton of pre-recorded intros for the next 4 weeks. And then I will hold over any new patrons, announcements, things until mid-November. So that's what's happening. I'm off to Denver for Digital Commerce Summit on Tuesday. Then I will be at the Oregon coast with Dean Wesley Smith, Christine Catherine Rush, which I'm very excited about. I will hopefully be doing some Facebook Live videos, things like that. I'll be on Twitter. I'm not going off grid, just off road, I suppose. Okay, so thanks as ever for your emails and tweets. I love getting them. So keep sending them, even though I am away for the next few weeks and won't be reading them out. I will still respond to you. So if you email me or tweet me, I will say hi back and follow you back, etc. So thanks to Simon Stanton, who sent me some lovely pictures of the English cemetery in Florence, Italy. And 2 more graveyards this week. Eleanor Delmas sent me a Chinese graveyard in Chiang Mai, which was really cool. And Imogen Clark, a graveyard looking for Adam Smith's grave with my German childhood pen pal, thought of you. So thanks for the pictures, everyone. I always love getting pictures of graveyards. I appreciate that. Go Taphophiles. Chris says, I'm really enjoying the updates on End of Days. On the episode, one episode you said, I'm in that part of the writing process where the plot has gotten away from me. It's really nice to hear and encouraging to hear about your process, like seeing someone as they climb a mountain. Chris says he lives in a Buddhist kendo, so he likes to listen while doing work like mopping or sweeping, and sent me some great pictures there. Rachel Amphlett said, thought you'd like this picture of Floyd the dog eavesdropping on me while I was listening to your recent podcast with Jan Murray. Very cute dog. Libby Cutt said, feeding my dreams again by listening to your podcast as I work. I worry they're getting too big. And no, you can never dream too big, Libby. Keep dreaming. Craig Schaefer, listening to the podcast on a research trip in Vegas. Great show as always. I particularly enjoy Craig's Daniel Faust series, which is dark fantasy, supernatural and cool stuff set in Vegas. So always wonderful to know when an author I like is listening to the show. Ruth Wetherill says, listening to the show while watching Deer and hearing I'm not alone in the pit of self-doubt. And this is what I mean about the mindset stuff. It's like people need to hear this. And that's why I wanted to share this interview with you, because I think we all sometimes believe that everyone else is all fine and everyone else is just out there being all professional and making money and being happy and being perfect. But that's just not true. So we're all in this together. Rose Arrowsmith Deku sent me a really lovely massive grin picture. Rose, you do make me smile. You've got a very lovely face. Listening to your podcast about editing and giddily talking to the broom. That and lots more. I got lots more, but that's just a few of them. So thank you. Really, really thank you, actually, this week. I wanted to say a big thank you to all of you for emailing, for tweeting, for supporting the show on Patreon. I really love the interaction we have on the show, and I take the responsibility of this podcast more and more seriously, actually. I was out with my cousin's daughter, she's 13, and I was explaining what a podcast was. And, I said, I'm trying to help people. And, you know, she was like, well, how do you do that with a podcast when you're just talking? I'm like, well, I'm hopefully people are finding something useful in what I say and or the people I interview. And that's why these emails and tweets that you guys send me mean so much, because I realized that you are listening and you do find it useful. So I'm going to do a survey before Christmas. When I get back, I'll do a survey for my podcast listeners so that we can try and make 2017 super useful for everybody. So get thinking about what you would like for the show in 2017. Okay, so today's episode, it's actually sponsored by my own book, The Successful Author Mindset, because that's what we're talking about on the show, which is available in ebook, print, audiobook, and workbook versions. And you can find all of that at thecreativepen.com/mindset. This corporate sponsorship or this business sponsorship or me talking about salesy stuff pays for the hosting and transcription, but my time in producing the show is primarily sponsored by you guys. So a big thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon, especially new patrons this week, Marcia McIntosh, Bruce Beck, and Julie Golob. Thank you to everybody. I really appreciate it. And I also yesterday released the October Patreon subscribers only Q&A show early, as I'm pre-recording everything. And I had a ton of questions through, so thank you, everybody. If you would like that extra audio, in fact, a whole year's worth of extra audio, then you can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Okay, let's get on with the interview with me. And I'll see you soon.
We're excited to welcome Joanna Penn to the podcast. Joanna is a New York Times and USA Today bestselling thriller author, as well as a writer of nonfiction books for authors. She's an independent author who has written 20 titles and sold over 450,000 books in 74 countries and 5 languages. The Creative Pen is where she offers information and inspiration on writing, self-publishing, book marketing, and how to make a living with your writing through articles, podcast episodes, videos, books, and courses. Her latest book for authors is The Successful Author Mindset, which came out in July. Joanna, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on the show, guys. I'm really pleased to be here.
So we just want to dive right into the questions because we've got so much that we want to talk to you about. Starting with mindset for the new mindset book, what do you find are the most common mindset issues for authors?
Yeah, well, this was so interesting because, you know, I wanted to write the mindset book because I think we all actually suffer exactly the same stuff. Like, I think what's kind of surprising is that even the top authors in the business suffer from some of these same issues. And when I was writing the book, I thought I need to put them in the order that people suffer them. So the very first chapter of the book is about self-doubt and imposter syndrome, because I think this is the biggest issue that we all suffer. So even authors authors as, you know, David Morrell, for example, who, you know, at Thrillerfest, I write thrillers, so I tend to talk about thrillers. David Morrell's famous for Rambo, the character of Rambo, and, you know, has been publishing for the last 50 years, you know, really a veteran of the business, you know, says that when he reads his words, he thinks they're crap. And, you know, the self-doubt over whether this next book will sell, or, you know, whether, you know, we will actually be able to make any money from a book, or whether it's any good, you know, this, or whether you can even call yourself a writer. We've just had a festival here in the UK. And I, you know, in the Facebook groups that you hear, you know, authors saying, oh, I just sat in the corner because I just felt really inadequate. And these are prize winning authors, you know, who most people would see on the front of a book, you know, whose name on the front of the book and think, wow, they're like the top of the career. So I think that's probably the first thing, is to understand that everyone has this self-doubt, and imposter syndrome is literally just the extension of self-doubt. So it's when you are, you know, a New York Times bestselling author and you've sold all these books and you're what most people would think of as successful, you're sitting there thinking, oh my goodness, you know, they think I'm an author, but what if this next book is a flop? And so that's probably the biggest issue, I think. And every author will suffer self-doubt at some point. It never goes away. It just changes as part of the process.
I liked how you put the book together, because it really flowed, I thought, from kind of the basic issues on, you know, through to like when you're a career author and the issues that you battle there.
Yeah, it was, I think when I was doing it, and it was a very difficult book to write, because obviously it's quite personal and I put my own diary entries in it and that type of thing. But I what's been interesting is people have said, it's like you read my mind. And I was very scared. I had a lot of self-doubt about putting this book out there, because I thought, oh no, people are going to read it and then they're, you know, I am an imposter and I do feel all these things. But actually, when you're honest about how you feel, that's when people resonate with you. And I'd urge people listening, you know, if you are writing, then just really put yourself onto the page, and that is what will resonate with people, is being real and kind of owning up to who you are. Even if you're writing under a pen name, you know, you're still being real in an emotional sense, and that is what resonates with people.
What are the mindset issues that you found that are more difficult to battle?
Well, I guess let's say another common fear, and then I'll get onto personally, but a common fear is this fear of rejection and fear of criticism. And this holds a lot of people back, however they publish. Obviously, fear of rejection, you get that if you submit to agents, submit to publishers, but also now we get it as indie authors from reviews. So that, you know, fear of rejection from new readers, so the fear of the one-star review, you know, fear of rejection from our peers if we write something that is difficult in some way. Or, you know, one of the reasons people use pseudonyms in the romance space is because it's not acceptable in many places to write some of the stuff that people write. So this fear of rejection, criticism, fear of failure, a lot of this stuff is bound up in the training we've had over many years, and the schooling and our families, and these big issues that we just can't hope to overcome. We just have to face them. And for me, this sort of manifested in self-censorship. So I'm a very happy, smiley, jolly person, and my nonfiction is very upbeat, very self-help, but I write darker fiction. So and my favorite author would be Stephen King. And, you know, I'm in the action adventure thriller genre, but some of my writing is towards the darker end. So the London Psychic series is quite dark, and I write some violence. And this type of stuff is, you know, even my mum said, why can't you write something nice? You know, and when people say, like, why can't you write something that's more like Hilary Mantel, was the classic quote, who wrote Wolf Hall, this historical, you know, Booker Prize winning literary fiction that took 10 years to write. And this, you know, it's still obviously it still grates on me, that kind of why can't you write something nice. So I self-censored until my fifth book. In my fifth book, which was Desecration, and you can tell a lot from the title, I just let it all hang out. And I think this is part of that emotional journey that you have to go on, and finding your voice is a lot about sort of getting over that fear of judgment, fear of failure, and letting it be out there. So those are kind of, I guess, some of the more deeper issues. And certainly my own issue is always fighting sort of, you know, self-censorship.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we were setting up this interview, we sent you a blog post from an author who's a friend of ours. And we've seen a number of posts like it lately from authors who I think are going through several things. You know, they're comparing to others. They're not quite satisfied with where their career is and issues like that. What do you recommend to those authors to kind of help get them into a better mindset, I guess, is just the simple way to put it.
Yeah. So, well, on that comparisonitis thing, as I call it, again, that's very common. I suffer from it too. But I did, last weekend, I actually walked 100 kilometers. I did this 100 kilometer race to the Stones. And that taught me a lot about comparisonitis, right? Because, so it was 50K and then I slept and then I did 50K. And it took me around 26 hours to walk the 100K. The winner took 8 hours. And I came in the very like last quartile of people on the end of Sunday, but a whole load of people never even finished. And when I've been thinking about this a lot, I've been thinking this is exactly like the writer's journey and this comparisonitis thing. I've been training for 6 months, right? And there's a lot of people listening who be like, I can't do 100K. And it's like, okay, sure, because you haven't done the training, but there's no way I could have done it in 8 hours. So how can I compare myself to the person who is an ultra marathon runner? And how can the person who hasn't done any training compare themselves to me? So this is the same with our writing journey, but we seem to think that writing, everyone should be on the same level. So the comparisonitis for me is, okay, how can I compare myself with Stephen King? I can't. He is like the ultra marathon runner. He's been writing, training for the last 40 odd years since, you know, he started writing like age 7 or something ridiculous. And in the same way, you know, we have to think of our writing journey, why are you doing this? You know, to me, this is a lifelong journey. It's, you know, you can learn new stuff as a writer until you die. And so if you're going to be writing until you die, how can you be at the top of the game right now? You know, I'm 41. I hope I'm not quite middle-aged yet. You know, I'd like to get to 90, a fit 90-year-old. So I have a long way to go. So that's why I think the very first thing is, we need to stop comparing ourselves to other writers. You don't know how long they've been writing, how many words they've written, how many different genres they've published in, how many names they've used. You know, you just can't compare apples with apples in this writing space. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, when I looked at that blog post, obviously there's the standard issues of self-doubt, fear of failure, but also not making enough money from the books. And, you know, one with love, saying with love, you have to look after your psyche and your, you know, your self-doubt, be nice to yourself. And then you have to kick yourself up the ass and say, seriously, no one owes you a living. Certainly not from writing, certainly not from your art. How many artists actually make a living from their art? The reality is that most people have other jobs. Now, for me, my other jobs, you know, I have 12 fiction books now, and I like a good living. I wouldn't say that those 12 books make me a full-time living still, but I have 8 non-fiction books. I do courses, I do speaking, I do other things that make me income that could be equated to like day job income. So this is what I would say to people. It's like, why are you writing? If you went into this to make as much money as a day job, then it takes a while, as any job, you know, you have to become a better writer and get a backlist. So basically, be nice on one hand and be gentle with yourself. And on the other hand, go, seriously, just like do the work and put in the time, create the backlist, and also consider writing in other genres. You know, as we briefly discussed before the show, you don't have to just write in gay romance. You could write straight romance, or you could write other genres, sci-fi, fantasy, whatever else you want to write, non-fiction. There's lots of things that we can write and we can use our writing skills to do. So I hope that's not too hardcore.
Well, I think you make a good point about the other genres. We talked a little bit before we started about, you know, Data Guy's review of the romance genre and how gay romance sits squarely in the middle of the high and the low. And you also make a good point about nonfiction, because you do make a good chunk of your income, as we know, because you put your numbers out there from your nonfiction books.
Yeah, exactly. And I actually find, like, you know, I finished my last novel, I think it was March or something. We're in July and I wrote a nonfiction. And I'm now starting to work on the next fiction and the next nonfiction. Writing in different genres can be like a palate cleanser and can actually help you renew that energy. Because let's face it, if you do go all out on a novel, which you should, never save anything for the next book because, you know, the creative well will refill itself. But when you empty yourself into a book, and I also put this in the mindset book, the feeling of being empty at the end of writing a book is completely normal. And if you don't feel empty, then you haven't given enough. But the thing is, then you need time to fill up that creative well again. And that takes time. Whereas actually writing nonfiction is much easier than writing fiction, because it's like you pick a topic and then you research the topic and then you write chapters on the topic. Whereas a novel is far more complex. And I think one of the issues right now in the indie author space, especially romance, is this sort of, you must publish fast, you must publish often, and people are burning out. And that's an issue. So to stop burnout, you have to do something else. So why not write a nonfiction, or why not write something completely different? Or do some freelance writing, you know, do some paid blog posts, do some journalism, do something else if you want to earn with your writing that isn't just the one genre that you've been writing in.
Mm-hmm. You use the word palate cleanser, writing your nonfiction books between the fiction, the thrillers that you write. For those who are listening, you've written some really terrific stuff about book marketing, about the business of being an author. Both those books we both love to death. Do you think those nonfiction titles are a way not only to cleanse your palate, but also to examine your own mindset, your own, the way you approach your author business?
Yeah, and like many people, I think many writers, I don't really know what I think until I write a book on it. So, You know, when I wrote, you know, Business for Authors, How to Be an Author Entrepreneur, I was actually trying to make sure my own business was robust enough. And as I did, you know, I basically, there's a really good book called The Personal MBA. I think it's Josh Kaufman. Anyway, so I got that book and I was like, okay, I need to go through this book and make sure my business stands up to the rigor of any other business. And in using that as a starting point, that's how I ended up writing Business for Authors, which then also helps other authors become author entrepreneurs. So you're exactly right. I want to, you know, write the books that enable me to learn about a topic. So when I first wrote How to Market a Book, the first edition, and I'm about to start on the third edition, but that first edition, I was learning book marketing at the time. And again, I wanted to codify what I thought in my head, and then it would help other people. And I was just, it's funny because I'm going to write a book on how to write a novel. And I think I'm ready for that now because I've written 12. And I feel like, okay, I think I need to work out how I write a novel and maybe improve the process. So I will do that. But I've got other ideas, like, for example, and this is what's great about writing. Of course, you always get more ideas. We just talked about self-censorship, and I did a lot of psychology earlier in my career. And so I want to write about the Jungian, Carl Jung's shadow side, and the importance of the dark side of our personalities and how you can use that. And I'm like, okay, well, I have to write a book on the shadow. That at some point I will do that. So that goes into the mix as something else I want to really research and understand. So if people are thinking, oh, maybe I could write nonfiction, think about any topic that you're interested in, that you're curious about, or maybe you're already an almost expert in it. And that could be anything, you know, like I have a friend who does a lot of knitting. Knitting is a really big sort of genre in fiction and nonfiction. Or, you know, my husband's into jujitsu. You know, you can do stuff on anything you like. It doesn't have to be about writing. That just happens to be my obsession. But I'm definitely looking to expand into other topics over time.
I wanted to ask about your love of Stephen Pressfield. we are fans of your show, The Creative Pen, and you've spoken about Stephen Pressfield several times. We have read his books. Anyone listening who hasn't read, you know, The War of Art, definitely should, you know, writers or creatives in general. It's an amazing book. What sort of struck me is Pressfield takes a sort of, he presents his subject in little kind of like bite-sized nuggets. There are little golden pieces of information that you can take away. And I felt that you present your book in sort of a similar manner. You tackle different problems, different mindset issues that authors have in a similar way. Did he influence the way you sort of attacked the subject and laid out the book?
Yeah, I think definitely. I mean, I hero worship Stephen Pressfield. And when I interviewed him on my podcast, I was like a ridiculous fangirl and I was kind of all giggly and ridiculous. But I think he quite liked that. But yes, I think what's happened also in the nonfiction space, and of course, The War of Art is a very slim book. Turning Pro, which is the kind of the one that goes a bit further, which I still reread several times a year because it's so hardcore. You know, is very slim as well. Seth Godin is another one who's writing small nonfiction. I think what's happened is it used to be that, but you know, because publishers ordered books to fit on shelves and had to have really big, you know, spines, that what nonfiction books used to be much longer. And now it's like, it's acceptable to write a short nonfiction book and price it accordingly. So, you know, the Mindset book, is like, I guess, a novella length in terms of fiction. And you would say also Stephen Pressfield's nonfiction is novella length, even though he writes like massive fiction. So yes, definitely, I think I've modelled his approach to the chapters, but it's also what I like to read. What I find with a lot of nonfiction that's traditionally published is it's so overly packed with kind of unnecessary material, and you can tell
there's fluff
in all, like they restate the same thing over and over again in a different way, and it's just like and you can tell with how many things are highlighted, whereas, you know, a Stephen Pressfield book, and I hope with my books at some point, every single paragraph should have something highlighted in.
Exactly, yes.
Because it's a different experience to fiction. Like fiction, you shouldn't, like, if you find fiction books that have been highlighted, they're usually literary fiction, or maybe there's a couple of highlights in our novels, but usually people want to sink in and just relax, whereas I feel nonfiction should earn its money by giving a lot of value in a small amount of space.
Well, speaking of giving value, this new book, the Mindset book, you have a couple of different editions. You have the ebook edition, of course, the print edition, and this time you've also done a workbook. And I was curious, what extra work did you put into the, before we came on this interview, I was actually in the other room and I was on Amazon, looking at the workbook. And I was curious as to, first of all, why you decided to do a workbook and what is, what's different about the workbook as compared to the text of the regular book.
Yeah, so I've also done an audiobook, which I've self-narrated as well. So basically, the idea in general is to turn our books into multiple streams of income. So the workbook idea, and I think I did one because I did an adult colouring book with my dad back in January, the English Country House and Garden Fine Art colouring book. And we did a notebook version of that, which is essentially exactly the same images, but with notebook pages in between. And the thing is, it costs, you know, I use a outsourced designer, and it would cost me around $60 to get a workbook version of a book made. Which is nothing, right? So why not create a version of a book that is a self-help book with questions into a notebook? So literally all I did was, and the workbook is exactly the same in terms of the text, but it has extra pages in where you can actually write the answers into the book if you want to. And it's a different size. So it's a 6x9 instead of a 5x8. And, so some people just want to have the book and some people like to write in it. But because it cost me barely anything to get an extra version, I just thought, well, why not? And some people really like that. So I've had, people send me pictures of them writing in, things. So I'm definitely going to, in the future, if it's appropriate. So like, I think with How to Market a Book, for example, I wouldn't do a workbook version of that. How to Make a Living with Your Writing, for example, that might lend itself to doing a workbook version. So that's kind of why I did it. And I think if you're writing anything where you're asking questions of the audience, of the reader, you could do that. I mean, why not?
How do you find that your mindset has evolved over your career and along with how you manage the issues when you have them?
Yeah, so I think the biggest change is the reality or the realizing that other people feel exactly the same. And I don't think things have changed, as in I still have self-doubt. I still have this empty feeling when I finish a book, this kind of feeling that, oh no, I'm never, ever going to write a book again. I feel so empty. What's going to happen now? I now recognize that that is just part of the process. I recognize that when I struggle with a full-length book, I'm not a detailed outliner. So around 25 to 35,000 words, I will suffer a problem and then I will have to do some replotting. But now I understand that's part of the process. So I think the main thing is that when I started writing, which is actually now 10 years ago, 10 years I started writing my first nonfiction book, I now understand my own psychological process and I keep journals and I write things down. But it's like, okay, so I'm empty. I now need to start filling my creative well again, for example. So at the moment, I'm starting to do research for End of Days, which is my next arcane thriller. And, I did a crazy thing. I came up for with the title, put it on pre-order, and then went, oh dear, I've just called a book End of Days, which kind of makes it, there's going to be some expectation around what that book's going to have in it. But also you need to do something original. So I have had a little bit of concern about that. But I understand that when I do research, stuff will emerge from the world. And as ever, it has synchronicity, serendipity, whatever you want to call it. This stuff will appear in the world when you start researching. So I think that's the biggest shift for me, is this realization of the creative process. And also, I guess just letting go and relaxing a bit more as well. I think when you're writing that first book, it's like everything is bound up in this one book. It's like the most important thing ever. And then when you put the book out there, you realize that it's just the beginning of something else. And in fact, I have this chapter on anticlimax and creative dissatisfaction, which I wondered whether to put in there. And I've actually said on it, don't read this if you're writing your first novel, because
exactly, yeah.
I don't think people want to know that. And they actually think that it is the pinnacle. Publishing that first book is the pinnacle. Well, it's not. It's like, actually, the writing is the point. And yeah, so I think, those are some of the things.
You mentioned the journals. In what was it like going back through all that? Because I really felt like you laid yourself bare in some of those chapters. And it's like, wow, I mean, that's brave, what you just put on the page there.
Oh, well, I'm glad you thought it was brave, because I was really worried about putting my journal stuff on there because of exactly that reason. It was like, what if people read it and they don't feel the same way? I mean, that would have been pretty awful. People, I was in a way, I was expecting a whole load of email that said, I never feel like that, but that didn't happen, thankfully. So what I did is I actually went through, like the last 10 years pretty much of my journals and, typed out parts of it. And I think what's interesting with writing, I don't know if you guys find this, but I find when I write stuff down, it's removed from my head. So some of these, like, I really believe that horror writers are the most psychologically healthy people out there, because they take all of their dark stuff and they put it on the page and then they're just super nice people, you know, they're not concerning at all. It's people who like romance, all happy, nice, the ones you've got to worry about.
They're the crazy ones.
They yeah. are. But those of us who write violence, we're just super nice. But I think some of those quotes, I'm like, ooh, that is hardcore, but I don't feel like that anymore. But I did at the time. So that's why I put it in there. Because over time we learn and we change. But it's like, you know, I also have journals from when I went through a divorce back in, goodness, a while ago now, because I'm in a happy second marriage. But when I look at the journals of my divorce, there's like three of them over a 4-month period. I don't even recognize that woman. Like the things that I was writing down, I don't recognize that person anymore. And it's the same with some of this stuff around creativity and mindset. If you write it down, you can move on. But if you don't, it will stick in your head. So I think that's part of the magic of being a writer is, you know, journaling or writing books. You can actually remove it from your head and get on with your life.
Mm-hmm. And I would assume this, that you've been in this now for 10 years, that perhaps the mindset for you has changed a little bit. So you're thinking more things that are like in the third section of the book for the career writers as well. I mean, do you find that to be true now?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's two things I'm pretty obsessed with that I go on and on and on about. And you guys, you know my writing and the podcast and stuff. One is this long-term thinking. I think too many writers get obsessed about like today's sales, tomorrow's sales, this month's launch, whatever. Whereas actually this is a long-term journey, and also that you die at some point. And so why waste any time at all writing a book you're not interested in? This is why I know some people write like for day job money, but I consider that to be like freelance writing. If you're writing for day job money, that's all it is. But if you are writing as your creative muse, I guess, inspires you, then work on things that you really care about, because we don't have much time on this earth. So I think that's really important. So that's one of my obsessions, is this long-term thinking. And the second one is the multiple streams of income idea, as we just talked about, you know, with the mindset book. I put it out on the first day with those four different formats and the audiobook that I narrated myself. And you know, that to me is something that and the author you mentioned earlier, who's struggling with some money side of being a writer, this is also part of the thing. So you publish on multiple platforms, although I know in romance, KDP Select is, you know, pretty powerful. I'm thinking long term, you know, if you look at what's happening in Africa right now and Asia, I want to be selling to those people. And that's not KDP Select. You know, I think now only 45% of my income comes from the US. So 55% is now outside the US. That's a big shift in the last couple of years in terms of income. It used to be, you know, for many people, it will be 100% US and 100% ebook and 100% Amazon. That's a dangerous place to be. So thinking multiple streams of income, multiple platforms, multiple formats, multiple books, multiple series, you know, thinking about it that way, what you get is, and what I've seen true for me as an author entrepreneur, is every year my income expands. Not quite exponentially, but it is impacted by the choices of going wide in many senses of the word. So I think those are, you know, that and that fits into taking control of your writing career. And it felt like the author that you mentioned before felt kind of out of control. It's like, you know, I can't seem to create the thing I want to create. And so for me, it's about, if you take control of your writing career and you make decisions for the longer term, not just for next month, for example, then you might make different decisions around building the life that you want. And also, you know, to be fair, I spent 13 years doing a job I hated, and I refuse to do that now. So so I kind of make decisions around freedom. Freedom's a big thing for me. You know, for example, I don't want to be a publishing company for anyone else. This is a big thing. I get people asking me a lot, and a lot of indie authors are setting up publishing companies, which is fine, but authors are needy. And I don't want to run a publishing company, because I would spend a lot more time doing that. So I choose to do education and inspiration and sell courses, not consulting time, you know, that type of thing. So make these choices around the lifestyle you want, the future you want, and think long term.
Mm-hmm. And it's a topic for a whole other show, but I just want to let the authors know that you mentioned the audio for the Mindset book, and you've done, I at least know you did audio for Business for Authors that mm-hmm. you yourself recorded and did not go through ACX for it, but you have it available on your website, and authors who don't want to or can't take the leap to do an ACX recording can look at that as something they could have on their own website.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously you need traffic to a website in order to sell from your website. And I wouldn't do it with fiction. Although I say that, do you guys know Scott Sigler? No,
I know the name of him.
Yeah, he's like the most famous, I think, podcasting author. He's been doing his own fiction audio for must be nearly 10 years now. So he will write a chapter and he will record it. And he's a, you know, big New York Times published author, traditionally published. But in all his contracts, he says, you know, I will continue to put out free audio on my website. And he's been doing it for years. And people love him. And you know, he'll kind of read like a try and be a woman, and it will be a not great, but he does it very well. So I have considered, what if I started reading my own fiction as well as nonfiction? Because I think, again, it's very empowering and you take control. So, you know, I've recorded Author Mindset. I sell it from my website. I can change the price. And this is the big issue with ACX, right? I mean, I don't know about you guys, but my income from ACX has dropped in the last year as people have signed up for their subscription service and we get paid much less money per recording. So this is the issue with audio. There was this small period where it just went nuts and was great, and now it seems to have dropped off a bit. So that's why I decided to sell direct, just to see how it goes. However, I would say that we're not at a point where audio, you know, MP3, I mean, podcasts are great because they can appear on your phone, right? But at the moment, if someone buys an audiobook direct, it doesn't appear on their phone. So I talked to the Book Funnel, Damon from Book Funnel, if they could do something with audiobook, you know, that it would appear on their device, that would change the game around selling audio direct.
Yeah.
But at the moment, people have to pay for the MP3, download it, put it onto their device, you know, sync it up. That's
yeah, the whole side load thing.
Yeah, the side loading thing. Whereas what's happened with podcasting, you know, podcasting really, really took off when, you know, everyone used a smartphone and could subscribe and it just appears.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned, obviously, the long goal, the long term. And it's a good shifting point to talk about author entrepreneur a little bit. The Business for Authors book, when it came out, I listened to it in early... I guess it was late 2013. Yeah, I think that's right. And the next year, like coming into the next year, it really turned my mindset. And it's like, this writing thing should no longer be a hobby. Mm. It's what I want to do. And while I can't give up my day job yet, it should become this side business, this business that I grow that has a plan, that has a schedule. At what point should authors consider, you know, making that shift to author entrepreneur? And how do you really know when it's right for you to do that?
Oh, I'm so pleased. Thank you so much. I'm really glad that that book had an impact. And it's funny because it and what's interesting, and this is a big point, it hasn't sold that much. And I think what's interesting, the reason I wrote How to Make a Living with Your Writing is literally because of the title. So Business for Authors, How to Be an Author Entrepreneur is quite thick, right? It's a full-length book. But what seems to be interesting is most people don't want to run a business. So I wrote a shorter version, How to Make a Living in Your Writing, which sells like gangbusters. And it is a smaller, much, much thinner, smaller version with much of the same information, but it kind of done in a much lighter way. So what's interesting with what you're saying is you found that book at a time when you were kind of ready for it. What I think is that if you take the, and this is the same again with any career, right? So I left IT consulting And some of my friends are now partners in consulting firms. You know, there are people who became lawyers out of university and end up partners in law firms. But there are lots of people who fall out along the way. Same thing with being a writer. I think a lot of people will write, well, a lot of people will say they want to write and never write. A lot of people will write one book. When you get to three books, I think that's when you actually start to think the question, you know, about the questions you're thinking. So how many books did you have when you started considering that?
I believe I was writing the third novel.
Yeah.
And also I'd had several shorts out.
Yeah. See, I think three is the magic number. because if you, you know, you, if you write one book, good on you, you've written a book, but then you realize, oh, I have to write more in order to make any money. And also, you know, I just want to try it again. If you write three, I think that you understand a lot more how to write a book. And also, you've either got the taste for it or you haven't. So a lot of people will disappear at three, I think. At two or three books, a lot of them will go away because it's hard. This is not an easy business. You know, it's the same as any other creative work. Nobody guarantees you any money. So you kind of have to decide, are you doing it because you truly, truly love it and because it suits you as a person? And as we've discussed, you know, I'm an introvert like most writers. I like being on my own. I don't like talking to people, therefore being a writer, except for you guys, obviously. Being a writer is the best career for me, someone like me. So I got the bug. And I think if you get the bug, then you start thinking, especially if you're in a job that you don't enjoy, then you start thinking, how can I do this more seriously? And that's when you should start thinking about a business. And when we say a business, we don't necessarily mean incorporation. It just means, for example, setting up a separate bank account. So I know in the US, I did an interview with Helen Sedwick and her book, Legal Handbook for Authors or something like that, for self-publishing. The Self-Publisher's Legal Handbook, I think it is. That has a whole lot of stuff on when you, you know, what type of structure you should have and the tax stuff for the US. But I think even if you have a separate bank account, you can start offsetting your costs against your tax paid, and the little bit of income you make will go into that bank account. And you, and that in itself means you're taking things more seriously and it's not just a hobby. So I think after three books, you pretty much will start making that decision. And then as time goes on, I definitely think you should not give up your day job unless you have at least 6 months income saved. I had 6 months when I left, and I also had $1,000 a month, which isn't that much money obviously, but I had 6 months income in the bank to give myself time to kind of build things up. Plus I have the two businesses, fiction and nonfiction, and a whole load more stuff. So I think the leaving the day job to go full time, you really do need to be very sure and have a lot more, you know, backlist behind you. Don't give up your job on the first, like, I think we've seen it in the romance space. There's a whole ton of people who left their jobs like a couple of years ago, 2013 or something, you know, big year, KDP Select came in, people making loads of cash. And so many of them have gone back to day jobs because that income has dropped. So it needs to be a sustainable income before you shift that far. But certainly at three books, you should probably know whether you enjoy this enough to know whether you're going to carry on.
Mm-hmm. And much like the Mindset book, the thing about Business for Authors, while it is a larger book by far than Mindset, you still break it down chunk by chunk, bit by bit, and make it possible for to essentially pick, well, I need to do this, this, and this now, and perhaps later I come back and become the corporation. Because it's very much how I started. It was, I set up a separate bank account like the day after New Year's Day, like whatever the next bank day was, set up the bank account, started to make a schedule. The schedule may move because there's still a day job that can impact me in ways that I can't forecast. But, you know, there's a pattern to it. And maybe, fingers crossed, by 2020, the backlist is enough that maybe I work less or whatever.
Yeah. And I think this is why I reread Turning Pro by Stephen Pressfield several times a year, because I think this idea of turning pro, you know, you turned pro the day you set up that bank account, really, because you were basically saying, I am taking this seriously enough. You know, everyone has hobbies that they spend money on out of their own bank accounts. And for writing, for most people, is a hobby and or a creative pursuit. But it's very, very different when you take it seriously. And turning pro is a process. You know, the reason I keep rereading that book is because I'm certainly a professional author. Absolutely. But every time I read that book, I go, I don't have a professional attitude about that. Like, comparisonitis is a really big issue with me. And that's why I keep reading Turning Pro, because he says something like, you know, the amateur compares themselves to others. And I'm like, oh, I just failed that one. I'm an amateur. You know, the professional does it this way. So for me, I think this is, you know, you have to keep investing in yourself, investing in the process of becoming, well, of becoming, you know, that is the thing. I mean, all of this is a journey, and that's what's so brilliant. What I love, love, love about being an author is we can literally be learning new things up until the day we die. And, you know, P.D. James, Phyllis, who was amazing author, died at, I think, 96. And one of her, I saw her speak at about age 94 or something. And she said her biggest fear was dying with an uncompleted manuscript. So when she did die a couple of years ago now, I was like, oh, God, I hope she finished a draft of whatever it was, you know, because I think she had a fear of them publishing whatever her unfinished book was, you know, like they did with Michael Crichton, which I was so angry about, because that book Micro, the last one he had, he only had that in draft and it reads like crap, you know. It really is. The point is, you know, we have this for a lot, we're gonna do this for a long time, hopefully. If you love it, why not do it till you die? And I fully expect to be very wealthy, like Stephen King and James Patterson and, you know, Nora Roberts. Those authors who have a massive backlist are wealthy, because the intellectual property assets will make you money over the long term. But I'm sure, you know, you guys are aware, it's the authors who have, let's say, 30 books, 50 books, who are making seven figures and more. You know, the eight-figure authors, you know, who we know in the romance space have a lot of books. So this is the thing for me. And obviously, it's not just about the money. But if it is partly about the money when you're turning professional, then you want to see where that line is. So when I met Bella Andre and Liliana Hart and, you know, Jacinda Wilder and people like that, I remember meeting them a couple of years ago. And I went, do you know what? They're brilliant, but they're nothing special. They are just committed authors who love what they do, who have written their socks off and have built this, you know, multi-million dollar business from their books. And that I turned a bit more pro that day when I realized that the size of your backlist is one of the biggest things in terms of that sustainable income. Because then, hey, even if each of your books only sells 10 books a month, you're doing really, really well. And I point people also in the direction of Dean Wesley Smith and Christine Catherine Rush, who are like my mentors. I'm like, I worship them. Because they, again, they've been in the business 40 years. They have, I think, over 500, 600 books between them. And none of, you know, and they get criticized a lot because they're not mega bestsellers, but it doesn't matter because they have been mega bestsellers. They've won loads of awards, but basically they have this massive backlist. So anyway, I hope that's encouraging.
Yeah. Yeah. Joanna, I wanted to circle back to something really quick. Earlier, you were talking about being forward thinking and about having, you know, multiple books and multiple streams of income. And I think for maybe some of the authors who are listening to this right now, that may have gotten them really excited and they felt really gung-ho and it's like, yeah, that's exactly what I need to do. But on the other hand, there may be some authors who are terrified of that and it seems incredibly overwhelming. Mm. Do you think that forward-thinking mindset is a prerequisite to success? Like we were just talking about, you know, people who are in this for the long haul and have a massive, essentially, backlist. Do you think being enthusiastic about the future is one of the most important things about mindset and success, hopefully.
Well, I think obviously there are no rules, and what's right. interesting with publishing and what the publishing industry count on are these unicorn books, you know, that come out of nowhere. Like Girl on a Train this year has been, or the last year or whatever, has been the book that has just gone nuts, you know, and everyone was like, everyone's reading that. Does anyone remember her name, or will anyone read her next book? I don't know. You know, so, but that's an example of a, and Hugh Howie to some extent, and he will say it, you know, he, with Wool, you can't replicate the success of a unicorn book. You can't do a J.K. Rowling. So when I think it, this partly comes down to definition of success, which I think is super important for anyone to think about. So if your definition of success is holding your book in your hand, awesome. Don't think about 10 years in the future. Think about finishing the book. Think about publishing it however you want to publish it. But what, so that's a goal you can achieve, and you can say, I am successful, I am holding my book in my hand, even if it sells 5 copies, or you give it to your mum or whatever. If your definition of success, which for me was leaving my day job, making a 6-figure income, you know, hiring my husband out of his job, which I did last year, which was like a big, you know, these definitions of success are much bigger. I certainly didn't think of those things when I wrote my first novel back in, you know, 2011. I was not thinking that I would be able to make so much of a career in writing. Certainly, I never thought that. But that's because this is a journey. So you have to have appropriate definitions of success as you move up the scale as such. I'm also one of those goal setting and achieving type of personalities. I always have to have a goal, and I know not everybody's like that. So yeah, of course, chill out, write a book, do what you like. There's no worries. What I get though is I get emails from people, for example, and this is the extreme example, but you know, I probably get 3 emails a week. I write poetry, how can I make a 6-figure income? And it's like, well, mate, it's got nothing to do with your poetry, unfortunately. You know, I don't think, well, unless you're a rapper, like I think rappers are poets, they do pretty well. But most people writing poetry cannot make a 6-figure income from poetry, I would just say, you know. But, and also it's like, okay, how can I have Andy Weir success? How can I write The Martian? You can't do that either, because that's, you know, that's the luck part of the publishing industry. So when I thought about my definition of success, you know, which is having a good life and, you know, making enough money that I can travel and do the things I want to do, look after my family, that type of thing. What can you do that you are in control of? And the only thing there is developing a backlist. So I, you know, if you calculate, if you do the word calculation on how many words you need to write a book, how many books you need to make, let's say start with $100 a month, then how many books do you need to make $1,000 a month, and then how many books do you need to make $10,000 a month, which for most people they'd be pretty happy with, right? If you make $10,000 a month. Yeah. So, but it's just a matter of doing the sums, because hopefully, I mean, you know, and or if you're right at the beginning, make $10 a month, right? So, and I went through this recently with a friend of mine, and she'd, you know, she'd just written her first book, and she'd just got, I think it was about £7, which is about $10, right? Except the pound's really weak right now. So maybe $12. So she got her first £7 in her bank account, and she was like, this is really disappointing. What can I do with £7 or $12, you know? And I'm like, but that's where we all start, isn't it? You know, most of our first payments as an indie are very, very small. But then, or you, if you can make $10, then you can make $100. And if you can make $100, you can make $1,000, and so on. It's just a matter of, you know, creating that. And that's what's so exciting. Those intellectual property assets are the things that will keep paying over time. So no, I don't think it's necessary to have the long-term thinking unless your stated definition of success is to make a living this way.
Mm-hmm. I think you make a really good point about your own individual definition of success and how that may change over time, and not succumbing to comparisonitis you get your royalty statement 1 month and you're stamping your feet because you're not making Andy Weir money. And you know what? You're not Andy Weir. So of course you're not making his money. You have to have your own, realistic definition of success. I think that's a really good point.
Yeah. And I like to talk about George R.R. Martin as well, because the guy's been writing fantasy for how blooming long? I mean, a long, long time. He's done loads of things and he's had his fame in a tiny niche, right? But who could have guessed that George R.R. Martin and Game of Thrones would be like the biggest thing? And I love it. I think it's brilliant. And it's just, and I read his books now. But, you know, I've spent most of my life never hearing of George R.R. Martin, and now suddenly right. here he is. Yeah. It's like he's exploded onto the scene, but he hasn't. He's been around for a really, really long time, just writing and writing and writing. And then something happens. I don't know. We get into a point in the world where the technology enables us to make really good TV, and there it happens. So this is the other thing about fiction, which is so awesome. You don't know what's going to happen with those books. So month one, like my London Psychic trilogy, I really love those books. Like, I think they're great, but they sell a lot less than my Arcane Action Adventure. And that's partly because they're darker and they're about psychics. Although I noticed psychic romance does really well, so I might have to spin that. But this is psychic mystery stroke crime. Which doesn't actually do that well. So, but the point is, those books could suddenly, something might happen in 10 years, 20 years time. Those books suddenly might take off and I make some money from them. So this is the thing. Whenever we create something, I think it's like Anne Rice, the vampire lady, you know, she says she's made money three times with vampires, you know, back in the 70s. And then when Twilight came out and now it's all happening again, you know, these things come around again. So don't worry too much. Just create things. And over time, they may find their place in the world.
Mm-hmm. That's really good advice. That's almost the pull quote for me, perhaps from this. What do you think is the most difficult part in adopting the entrepreneur mindset? Is it just that big word entrepreneur that you're like taking this to a different level or something else?
Yeah, I think it's that. And also, I realize that this is very overwhelming. Like, I know some people listening will be like, what is she talking about? You know, intellectual property assets? It's just a book. I think, you know, we all understand that we have to learn the writing craft. You know, we all understand that when we become writers and we invest in learning the craft, then we discover we have to learn about self-publishing if we're going to do that. And then we have to learn about marketing, which most of us never thought we would have to learn about, right? I mean, suddenly we become experts in marketing. And this is just another level of learning. So I think the overwhelm is often, I now have to learn something new, which is running a business. And this is the truth of it. You know, if you want to go as far as doing this full time, you have to sort out your taxes, you have to work with an accountant, you have to, you know, do all these different things that perhaps you never thought you would have to do. And to be fair, if you get a good publishing contract, you should also do the same thing. So it doesn't matter how you publish. But I think that is probably the biggest hurdle for people, is it's hot. There's some new language, there's new things to learn. But all I would say to people is it's just the same as learning to self-publish or learning to write a book. You know, once, like we know, right? Once you self-publish once or twice, you pretty much don't have an issue next time. Publishing is not a big deal. The big deal is learning to be a better writer, learning how to market, which is a bigger thing, and learning how to run a business. You know, I do it with my eyes closed now. So, but I had to learn those skills. So I think it's just, it can be overwhelming at the beginning as people are like, I just have enough to do just writing. Why do I have to do all this other stuff? But yeah, you, if you want to, and also I would say business is super creative, and you know, you're creating wealth. You potentially creating work for other people. You know, I work with 12 contractors, so I'm creating value in their lives as well as creating value in readers' lives and my own life. So it's a very creative thing.
Mm-hmm. Now, knowing what you know now, what advice would you give Joanna from 10 years ago when this was all starting out?
Well, I think the biggest thing that happened to me 10 years ago is what I still stand by, which is I read a book called The Success Principles by Jack Canfield, which is a brilliant book. And the very first thing says, take 100% responsibility for your life. And that's when I sort of had a big mindset shift. And it was like, oh, you mean I'm in a job I hate because I chose to be in a job I hate? Over these small decisions over time, I end up here. And I realized that in order to create my future, I had to start taking different choices, making different choices every day. So for example, are you going to get up at 5:30 a.m. and write, or are you going to stay in bed for another hour? And then if you stay in bed, you don't have any time to write today because you have to go to your day job. Or, you know, we made choices like that. And so I think looking back now, I would just say to myself back then, this is the right journey. You know, I think I felt for years that I was climbing the ladder, but it was the classic, the ladder's up against the wrong wall. And this time, you know, I've been building this, and just so people know, from 2006 to 2011, I was working, the day job and doing this type of stuff in the evenings, the mornings, the weekends, holiday, any time. I only went full time in 2011. And so I would say to myself, don't worry, this is the right wall this time. And there will come a point when what you're planning for actually will happen. And I hope that's a big thing for people. And I often say, and since we're in Olympic year, right, the Olympics is here, I often say to people, think about the Olympic time periods, because often 1 year is not enough to measure your growth. So think about where you were. So it's 2016. So 2012 was the London Olympics, right? So think of, and often people can remember where they were during the Olympics because you're just on the TV and stuff. So think about where you were in 2012. How many books did you have? What were you doing in terms of your writing? What did you know in terms of book marketing? Did you know anything? And then I think back to 2008, which was the Beijing Olympics, I had never written a novel. I never even thought I could write fiction. I was making about $10 a month, with my writing. I hadn't even started the Creative Pen in July 2008. So many things that didn't exist for me two Olympic periods ago. And so now if you think, wow, okay, I've come a long way, if you think about the Olympic period. So I hope that helps people sort of put that time in perspective.
Tell everyone where they can find you online.
Yes. So for writers, I'm at thecreativepen.com and pen with a double N. And I have a podcast, The Creative Pen Podcast, and obviously books and courses, and you can find it all there. And there's the free Author 2.0 Blueprint, which is kind of answers all the questions that most people have first time around. And my fiction is at jfpen.com, and that's F for Francis. If people like thrillers and crime and books like that, although maybe your listeners like more romance. I don't really have much romance, any romance at all. And I'm on Twitter at The Creative Pen if anyone has any questions.
Awesome. Joanna, thank you so much for joining us. I hope our audience gets a lot out of this because it was really great information.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, guys.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free Author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time.